Well, it's my great pleasure to do something that I don't get to do when I stand up in front of this podium, because normally I'm the person that gets to answer the questions. But this time, and the secretary's already pointed out that maybe I'm kind of a chicken for running out of here after I introduce him, so I don't have to take questions. But it is my great pleasure to bring the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, to the podium for his press conference. I have told him multiple times today how much I appreciate his willingness to come here to visit with the folks that he did just a little while ago, and I don't know how many questions you answered, but it was a bunch, Mr. Secretary. And we're really appreciative of the fact that this is a man, this is a leader, that will come spend that amount of time with us and visit with us. So without further ado, thank you, Mr. Secretary, and we look forward to continue to working together. So thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Thank you. Bob, thanks very much. And as I said on Bob Stallman Appreciation Day at USDA not long ago, we thank you for your 16 years of service to the American Farm Bureau Federation. It's been a 16 years of distinguished service. We've seen the Farm Bureau Federation grow significantly in membership, and you obviously were critically important both individually and the organization in terms of the passage of the Farm Bill, helping to advance trade opportunities for American agriculture, working through some challenging times with disasters that crop up from time to time, helping us with budget issues, and again, your work on the China Garden, very much appreciated. And I really appreciate your leadership in developing the Farmer and Rancher Alliance, which gives agriculture an opportunity to have a unified voice on issues and on the perception that others have about agriculture. And certainly I'm excited about the prospects for ag in the classroom, which Farm Bureau has provided, and Start to Farm effort, which is also part of our Beginning Farmer. I should have mentioned that to the young lady who asked about the Beginning Farmers, but all of that has been just incredible work, and so we appreciate your assistance and help. And now that Jerry Hagstrom's here, we can officially start the press conference. You're officially referred to as a straggler. I just want you to know, Jerry.
Well, I had to get the name of that lady that asked you all the tough questions.
Okay. All right, questions.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned earlier that there might be a meeting with regard to labeling and the Vermont law. How soon might that meeting come together, and who would be involved with attention toward the Senate?
Jeff, I've been asked by both sides of that issue to bring folks together who have been working and had been working prior to the passage of the omnibus budget bill together to determine whether or not common ground could potentially be established. That meeting is going to take place this week. From my perspective, USDA, our role is to convene. Our role is to encourage if there is consensus to be found, consensus so that a recommendation can be made to members of Congress who ultimately have the final say in this, if you will. If there's going to be any activity relative to the Vermont law, obviously it's going to have to be through Congress. And I think members of Congress, and particularly in the leadership positions at the ag committees, would appreciate knowing whether or not there is any middle ground, any common ground, any way to sort of weave through this these issues. We're going to explore that. I can't tell you whether there is. I can't tell you how successful or unsuccessful it could potentially be. We're going to try. And I will, following the meeting, it's my intent to communicate the contents of the meeting and the tenor of the meeting to the leadership of the ag committees so that they're aware.
What are the points that you feel need to be made on both sides of that issue?
Well, I don't want to prejudge what folks think is doable or possible, Jeff. I think the question is, I think that there are concerns on one side of the issue with the impact on the marketplace if there are multiple requirements in multiple jurisdictions. Can there not be some kind of standard approach or some way in which industry can create a standard approach? On the other hand, I think there is a growing recognition on the part of just about everybody in this discussion that consumers who are interested in knowing the process by which food was produced have the right to know that. from my perspective, I want to make sure that if that right is respected, that it's respected in a way that doesn't necessarily send the wrong message about the safety of food that's produced with genetically modified crops, because we know there is not a safety issue there. This is not about safety. This is about consumers' right to know and doing it in a way, in my view, that sends that doesn't create a misperception about the safety of the product.
Or, after your visit to Cuba, what is your feeling about the possibility of the embargo being lifted and ag trade?
Well, I think, Orion, the ag trade would definitely benefit. Obviously, it's a market that in the past we have had a significant market share. We've seen a decline of that because of the restrictions that are placed on doing business between Cuban interests and American interests. To the extent the embargo could be lifted, it would make trade a lot simpler and a lot easier. And I think we would see growth, significant growth in ag products sold to Cubans. I think they're interested, and they certainly have a need. They export or import, rather, 80% of their food needs for a country of 11 to 12 million people. That's a big market opportunity for us. But the embargo has to be lifted for several reasons. One, to reduce those barriers to credit and to doing business directly with Cubans. Secondly, it would free up our ability at USDA to use the market access programs and market promotion programs that we have by investing in trade shows and reverse trade shows and all the things that we've done with everyone else that has allowed us in the last 7 years to do $900 billion of ag trade. We can't use any of those tools today because of the embargo. I think we're a ways away from a Congress that's willing to do that. I don't know that the current Congress is willing to take that up. But I think as we see more of the travel restrictions and so forth break down, more of a willingness to work between the Cuban and American officials, I think eventually that embargo will be removed. And when it is, I think American agriculture is going to be poised to take advantage of it, because we now have state ag commissioners, state ag secretaries leading trade missions, using their trade promotion efforts to establish the relationships that will lead to more trading opportunities that we're right now restricted in doing on the federal level.
Will you open an office there for USDA?
The capacity for us to have representatives in Cuba is somewhat dependent on working with the State Department. We'll continue to work with the State Department. Right now they're operating in somewhat of a constricted geographic facility, and their office space is very limited. And in order to do it right, you got to have adequate office space. You also have to have the Cuban government basically be okay with it. So there's still, I think, several hurdles to cross. But we have expressed an interest in, when it's appropriate, when it can be done well, to have a presence down there, because we think it would be helpful. We think it would be helpful in developing a relationship and in providing information. I think the Cubans could benefit from the same kind of technical assistance and fellowships and so forth that we provide other countries, and it builds that relationship, which makes that trading opportunity a little easier to conduct.
Mr. Secretary, you were asked by a Texas cotton producer in the town hall about the oilseed designation for cottonseed. I think you called it a difficult situation. Tell us, can you do it right now?
We are in the process of evaluating what options, if any, I have. I can tell you the process. I can't necessarily tell you the result of the process, because the result has not been completed and I haven't seen all the information I've requested. But here's what I can tell you. Number one, we understand and appreciate cotton growers are under stress. And we would like to be able to help to the extent that we can. So our team is looking at what can we do, what can't we do, whatever it is we can do, how do we do it. So first you have to determine what you can do. Secondly, you have to determine what, if any, budget impact it has, and if there has to be any kind of offset, and where that offset would come from, and how much of an offset you'd have to identify. And you also have to evaluate potentially the trade implications of anything you do. As you know, the Brazilians And the U.S. just not long ago settled the cotton case. And we do not, and they've just recently, the Brazilians just recently have expressed concerns about soybeans. We do not necessarily want to precipitate critical review of our farm bill on the trade and international side, because that could create serious problems. So it's a complicated set of issues that we have to work through and we have to think about. It may very well be that some of the options that are that we would like to think about, maybe even things we've done in the past, may not be available to us today because of statutory prohibitions that are contained in either a standing law or in an appropriations bill. So we have to know what those are. So when we go to Congress and say, this is what we'd like to do, we can't because of this provision, would you be willing to change this provision? Or go to Congress and say, this is what we'd like to do, but understand there is potentially a PAYGO responsibility, and how do you want us to deal with that? Or this is what we'd like to do, but we have some serious concerns about the impact of on trade and trade relations. Very complicated, but it starts with what can you legally do? And that's the answer I'm looking forward to getting very soon. That's really going to dictate the direction of what, if anything, we can do, because I'm not going to do something I can't do legally. Yeah, Jerry.
Back to the GMO issue. What's your reaction to Campbell Soup deciding to label genetically engineered foods? And on the food stamp issue, what do you think about the National Commission on Hunger recommending that food stamp beneficiaries not be allowed to buy sweetened sodas with food stamps?
You know, part of the challenge with the labeling issue is that there is no uniform approach. So every company, theoretically, every state and every jurisdiction, theoretically, has the capacity, the ability, and the right to decide for themselves what they're going to do. That's fine if you're dealing with one company in one community. But the reality is that these are major companies doing business in every community. And the question is, if you have this multiple layered approach, what is it going to do to the availability and the cost of food? In the Campbell's announcement, I did note that they indicated it's going to cost them more. Well, I imagine that their shareholders aren't going to bear the full brunt of that. So consumers are going to have to potentially bear the brunt of that. Is that okay with consumers? Is that okay? I mean, how is that going to impact and affect the activities of that company? They're obviously making a decision. I think it would be helpful and beneficial for Campbell's and for every other business in this space, from my perspective, to have the option of conforming to a single approach that theoretically everybody could conform to if they choose to do so. And in that case, I think you would probably end up with a more efficient system, less questions, potentially less cost, and doing it in a way that respects people's right to know, but doing it in a way that doesn't create the misimpression about the safety of a product. It's not an easy thing to do. It's just not an easy thing to do. And, you know, there's an even bigger issue at stake here, and that is that this continued segregation that's taking place in this country on various issues of people who are for and against things, and the intense advocacy and passionate advocacy that occurs on all sides of issues, there needs to be somebody, some group, some entity that basically says, this is an important issue, but let's seek to find common ground. Let's seek to find our common interest here, and let's advance the common interest. And food and agriculture seems to me ought to be the kind of aspect of our society that should be easier to do that. It should, as I think I've said earlier, it should be a unifying, not a dividing set of issues. So to the extent that good, creative, thoughtful people could find common ground on this issue, it might send a message that even in areas where there are passionate views and divisive views, that people can come together, can find common ground, and perhaps that would provide an example in some of these other areas that we find are important to agriculture, immigration, and some of the other areas where we definitely have to find a common ground at some point in time. These problems are not going to go away. The issue of labeling is not going to go away. On the issue of the SNAP issue, the challenge with this, Jerry, is that it's more complex than it seems at first blush. And I probably didn't do a particularly good job of explaining it out there, but it is really hard to do this. And it is, and there are people who feel very, very strongly that we should not be distinguishing between people in terms of their food purchases. That, and on the other hand, there are people who feel very strongly that if they're providing support, it ought to be support for things that are healthier. And then there are people that say, yeah, but what about the situation where a person's in line because their child has had a great athletic contest or did well at school? Should people who are really struggling financially not be able to celebrate that moment in a way that they choose? Or how would you enforce this? So you got somebody in a line. Have you ever been in a grocery store and you got 15 people lined up with their carts, and the 19-year-old checkout person is there, and the dad with two small kids is going through the line, buying a jug of Diet Mountain Dew, and all of a sudden the lady says, well, you can't buy that, and then they enter into a conversation, and it holds everything up, and there's pressure, and finally the clerk says, just go ahead. How do you enforce that? So clerk, you find the clerk, do you find the store, do you take the store's ability to do SNAP away? I mean, it's complicated. It's again one of those issues that that divides us, and so we have been looking at ways in which we can use our SNAP Ed program to educate people how they can stretch their dollar. We've had, and I should have mentioned this earlier, we have an incentive program that's in place that the Farm Bill basically funded to try to find ways in which we can incent the right set of choices so that we're not in a situation where we're restricting people's choice, but we're giving them the information so that they make an informed and the right choice for their family. I think it's interesting, one grocery chain that I'm aware of did a survey, and they found that, one of the purchases that was high on the list of SNAP purchases was Mountain Dew, Diet Mountain Dew. But they also noticed that those same families weren't buying any coffee. And it occurred to the people who were studying this that maybe Diet Mountain Dew is an inexpensive form of caffeine. So, these are, unless you've been in the shoes of a poor family struggling, somebody's working a minimum wage job, trying to take care of a couple of kids, going to school at night, and there are many examples of that, boy, this is just a hard issue. Chris. Okay, Chris.
Mr. Secretary, I was wondering on maybe an update where we're standing with an undersecretary for trade, kind of moving back to the trade topic.
Congress has ordered multiple studies of this, and one of the studies is concluded, and they've ordered another one, and they've allocated another $1 million for study. Again, this is one of those issues where, can't you just set up an undersecretary for trade? I mean, that ought to be a relatively simple thing to do, except that it involves taking a look at a multitude of mission areas within USDA and determining whether or not it makes sense for areas of APHIS, for example, to be transferred to the trade area, or whether it's better for APHIS to stay where it is. Is it part of marketing and regulatory, or is it part of trade, or is it part of both? How do you separate those? What do you do with staff? What are the union concerns? Because some of the people that are impacted and affected by these decisions are part of a collective bargaining unit. How does that work? What kind of notification is required? It's complex. So we're working through all those complexities. But now Congress has asked us to do additional study, so we will do what Congress has asked us to do, and that, you know, that'll take a little time. The other issue, I think, is that if you do this, or how you do it, is going to have, obviously, a significant impact on the next administration, the next secretary, the next USDA. Does it make sense to do all the preparatory work and let the new secretary and new administration implement this in a way that works for them? I don't know. Until these studies are complete, I don't know how many steps it's going to take and whether or not that even makes sense to even think about. But given the fact that we're in the last year of an administration, it's something you ought to think about it, at least look at it. Chris, you had your hand up. I'll take your question.
Secretary, getting back to what in the town hall meeting, you talked a lot about the regulatory issues and average Americans not understanding farming and ranching. The rancher who asked you about the Hammonds, I spoke with him. He had a real fear of prosecution sometime down the line over, ranching practices. And then tomorrow we have a farmer here who's worried he's being sued by EPA over a plowing issue. So if there's this problem out here regulatory-wise with maybe the penalty or the regulatory action not necessarily fitting the practices in rural America or the situation, how do you deal with that? If you go back to your original premise that most Americans, most people don't understand what farmers and ranchers do on a daily basis.
Well, I don't necessarily think I've got the answer to that question, Chris, but I would make several suggestions. One is that we need to continue doing what we've started to do in the last several years with the help of the American Farm Bureau and the Farm and Rancher Alliance. We need to continue to market what farmers do to the rest of the country. We need to make sure that there's an education process so that there's an understanding and appreciation for what farming is involved. And then secondly, I think it's incumbent upon all federal agencies, I think this is just common sense, but on all federal agencies to think of themselves in terms and in relationship to customer service. So Farm Bureau, I think, is doing a survey of the members who are here at the convention on our programs. And we are fully supportive of that because we want to know how we can do a better job. We want input. There may be things we're doing that we shouldn't do, or there may be things we need to explain better. And you don't know that unless you are committed to customer service. And I think USDA has an advantage in this respect because we've got county offices and we've got people in every part of the country. And I think we like to think of ourselves as a service-oriented entity. But, the people's reaction to NRCS, people's reaction to Farm Service Agency offices, for the most part, has been positive because they're local folks trying to provide local services. And I think there's, a continued commitment to customer service, and I think we, within every level of government, ought to understand that it is ultimately about service. I remember I was mayor of a small town, and there was a huge snowfall that occurred in Mount Pleasant shortly after I was mayor. And we had a series of cul-de-sacs in Mount Pleasant. And after about 3 or 4 days, I had mayor's hours, and I got a call from a woman who was in one of those cul-de-sacs. And she hadn't had the snow removed, that cul-de-sac, so she couldn't get out. She obviously wasn't very happy, understandably so. So brought the person in charge of this operation into my office, and I said, hey, Armstrong Court, we got to get the snow removed. People are upset. And a guy walks out the door, and as he's walking out, he goes, whatever you say, Mayor, you're the boss. He got about halfway out of the door, and I said, hey, come back here. He said, I'm not the boss. The lady at Armstrong Court's the boss. She's not happy. Make her happy. It's an attitude. The mayor's not the boss. Secretary's not the boss. People are the boss. And I think that it's important that we remember that. And then I think we also have a responsibility as regulations are enacted to work to try to explain why it's important to have a regulation like the one we have. And I think oftentimes this is a general observation. I don't think we do as good a job as we should setting the stage, explaining to people why a regulation is being proposed, why it's being advanced, what benefit we think it will accrue. I know we send out information in the Federal Register, and I know there's a lot of public hearings and stuff, comments and that kind of stuff, but oftentimes, you know, it's, I don't know about you, but I don't know how many ordinary citizens read the Federal Register. How many people here read the Federal Register? Yeah, well, Chris, you know, I hate to tell you, but you're the only guy that raised his hand. So, you know, it's just not something, it's not, and if you look at the Federal Register, it's not something that just says, read me, you know. I mean, it's really small print, and it's oftentimes legalese, and there's a whole bunch of preamble stuff, and, you know, it's hard. And we've got to figure out, collectively, we have to figure out ways in which, as we're proposing things, as we think things are a good idea, taking the time and having the patience to explain it to folks. Now, we're not going to get it explained to everybody, and there's still going to be people that are upset and people aren't happy, and there are going to be people that feel put out and put upon. But I think we can substantially reduce that. And part of what we were trying to do at USDA is it, with our website and that kind of stuff, is making it so that people can actually use the information. And I think the Beginning Farmer and Rancher website is a good example of us trying to do that. And I think the reaction to it has been pretty positive. Okay, thanks all.